Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in session pursuant to adjournment. Master Commissioner Robert Mayer presiding.
Please be seated. The first case to be heard this morning is number 2010-0389. Hilliard City Schools Board of Education versus Franklin County Board of Revision. The appellant, Ms. Fox.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Carol Fox here on behalf of the appellant, Hilliard City Schools Board of Education. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal this morning. Before addressing the substantive issues involved in this case, I would like to quickly point out the clerical error that was made by the Board of Tax Appeals in its decision. It decided ultimately to allow the $800,000 deduction made by the Board of Revision for the personal property that was claimed to have been involved in the sale. It, however, deducted that amount from the auditor's value of $3.55 million rather than the sale price of $3.6 million. It is undisputed in this
case. So that the value that the BTA found was $2,750,000 instead of $2,800,000.
Correct.
And so you're saying it should under the BTA's theory, which you contest, be $2.8 million.
Correct.
Does the notice of appeal raise that as a separate issue, or?
I honestly don't recall if it raises it as a separate issue, Your Honor. It is undisputed that the property in this case sold for $3.6 million on February 1st, 2005, 1 month after tax lien date. We contend that the BTA's allowance of an $800,000 reduction for personal property from that sale price was both unlawful and unreasonable. The Board of Tax Appeals decision was unlawful because the Board of Tax Appeals applied an improper standard with respect to the personal property, and it was unreasonable as a result because it allowed a deduction based on evidence that it had already previously determined in its decision to be unreliable. The deed and the conveyance fee statement that were submitted in this case by the Board of Education at the Board of Revision hearing established the $3.6 million sale price. Neither the settlement statement nor the conveyance fee showed any allocation for personal property. This court has recently made it clear that the reporting of a sale price on a conveyance fee statement is significant, and that an owner who opposes the use of its own reported sale price carries the burden of providing evidence that the price does not reflect the true value of the sale, of the real estate purchased. Despite the sale documents that clearly stated otherwise, KDM claimed that personal property was included in the transaction. In order to meet its burden of proof, KDM had to prove two things. They had to prove, first of all, that the sale price, as reported, did in fact include a value for personal property. Second, it had to clearly establish what the fair market value or the value of that personal property was at the time of the sale.
Now, on the first point, there isn't really any dispute. I mean, this was sold as a going concern, this hotel, motel.
Sold as a going concern. There is, however, very conflicting and inconsistent evidence as to whether the $3.6 million price included any value for personal property. If you look at the documents that were presented and that are contained in the record in this case, there's a large stack on the table here beside me of those documents. Seven of those documents indicate that there was no value allocated for personal property. Those documents include the deed, the conveyance fee statement, the settlement statement, the purchase contract, the bill of sale, the security agreement, and the Hawthorne Suites manual. These were all documents that were in existence at the time of the sale. Although the purchase contract mentions the fact that personal property is to be involved, it also specifically states that property that is involved is supposed to be listed in an exhibit attached to the agreement. No such list was attached. The same is true for the bill of sale. The bill of sale says that the list of whatever property was included was to be attached. No such listing was ever provided or attached to the bill of sale. In addition, as we've already stated, both the conveyance fee statement and the settlement statement, which have specific lines and places for a reduction, or rather a deduction for personal property, both of those were left blank with respect to personal property. Two of the documents that are here before you consist of an independent appraisal and a servicing agent agreement. Those two documents reference personal property and place a value of $280,000 on the personal property. I would like to point out at this time that the appraisal was created by an independent appraiser for the purposes of the sale. The appraisal was done as of 2 weeks before tax lien date. It set forth a value for the property as it existed at that time. It was used. It was at least 6 or 7 years old. It was not new property. The Board of Tax Appeals properly rejected the testimony of Mr. Shaw in this case. It rejected that testimony as being unreliable and unsupported. It is Mr. Shaw's testimony and Mr. Shaw's allocation on which the Board of Revision based its reduction to the sale price. After it rejected the evidence that was presented by Mr. Shaw, the Board of Tax Appeals then turned around and affirmed the $800,000 deduction that was made by the Board of Revision.
Wasn't there a document that was a balance sheet?
There was a balance sheet. One document, this document, which is three pages. Unfortunately, we have no idea who created this document. We have no idea when the document was created. We have no idea what purpose it was created for. We have no idea, more importantly, what the underlying basis is for the figures that are on that on that balance sheet. If, in fact, as it was contended at the Board of Revision, that balance sheet was created for federal income tax purposes, then this court has already determined that that is an improper basis for valuing property for real property tax purposes. The balance sheet was nothing other than hearsay evidence and, quite frankly, the most unreliable piece of evidence in the entire record. And for whatever reason, the Board of Tax Appeals chose to hang its hat on that. Finally, the problem with the balance sheet that also remains is that it was a balance sheet as of December 31st, 2005. Again, if in fact personal property was included in the sale price, the value of that personal property must be established as of the sale date, not as of December 31st, 2005, 10 months later. With respect to KDM's claim that the disallowance of goodwill by the BTA was improper, of course, the Board of Education is in agreement with the BTA on this issue and believe that the decision of the Board of Tax Appeals is completely in accordance with this court's previous decisions in St. Bernard. We believe that none of the testimony indicated that there was any goodwill or business value. In other words, there was no support for that. I apologize. The fact that KDM seeks to deduct this when it was not valued or allocated at the time of the purchase is one thing. The fact that they provided no underlying support for their figure of $500,000, which again was an allocation made by Mr. Shaw that was unsupported, is a second problem. And the third and final problem is that as the BTA properly determined, any value that would have been credited to the goodwill or the business value should have been properly credited to the real estate. If you look at the record, all of the discussion regarding the business value or the goodwill centers around the franchise. And in fact, Article 6, Section 3B of the purchase agreement specifically required KDM to enter into its own franchise agreement with Hawthorne Suites. It would have been a separate agreement that KDM was required to enter into on its own and presumably pay for on its own, so the purchase agreement itself separates that out from the sale.
So now is your understanding that the purchase agreement then does or does not transfer a franchise interest?
It is our contention that the purchase agreement does not because it specifically requires KDM to enter into its own franchise agreement with Hawthorne Suites.
You had mentioned the appraisal, I think, was done for the lender in the sale, going back to the tangible personal property.
Yes.
And that there was something like in the nature of a $280,000 possible value for the furniture, fixtures, and equipment.
Correct.
But again, your position is that that's not probative either.
Our position is we feel like there were two burdens that KDM needed to meet. First of all, to prove clear and unequivocally that there was personal property involved in the sale. We believe that if you look at the record as a whole does not meet that. KDM did not meet their burden. If, however, the court would determine that KDM did meet that burden of proving that personal property was involved in the sale and included as part of the sale price, we would contend that the best evidence in the record of the value of that personal property would be the independent appraisal, which valued the property as it existed as used personal property at $280,000. The record is fraught with claims by Mr. Shaw at the Board of Revision and appellee throughout his brief that the allocation prepared by Mr. Shaw was somehow supported by the Hawthorne Suites manual. We would like to point out, as the BTA recognized, there's nothing in that manual that provides a value. The manual simply states what sort of personal property should be included within this type of a facility. We have no idea how Mr. Shaw arrived at his value. He came up with $10,000 to $12,000 per room, presumably for brand new personal property. But again, we don't know where that number came from, where he arrived at it, how he got those figures, what he utilized, or what the underlying basis was. Because of this, the BTA properly rejected his testimony and his allocation, but then turned around and affirmed his allocation with respect to the personal property. I'll reserve the rest of my time, if I might.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fox. Mr. Ernsberger. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
You did. Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court, Todd Ernsberger with the law firm of Onda Laboon, Rankin & Boggs, represent the appellee, cross-appellant, KDM & Associates in this case. I'd like to point out a few points with respect to this transaction. It was clearly ongoing business concern, acquisition of property, real property, personal property, and as we're going to identify, business value relating to the franchise agreement.
Could I ask you just to talk just a little bit slower?
Yes, sir. I'll have
to. I'm having trouble following.
Sure. We feel that there are two primary issues that Ms. Fox has identified in this case. The first being the fact that as to the personal property, there is substantive probative evidence as to the existence of personal property in this bulk sale transaction. As the St. Bernard self-storage case has identified, that if you have a transaction, the burden of proof is on the tax-paying owner to determine that there is a reduction in value. If there's going to be a reduction in value, you have to identify there's a bulk sale transaction. Substantial evidence exists, including the contract itself, the purchase contract, a bill of sale identifying that there was personal property coming along, substantial testimony of Mr. Shaw, which the Board of Tax Appeals did not determine was irrelevant or unresponsive as to the existence of the personal property or the goodwill itself. The Board of Tax Appeals solely said that his testimony was not the best testimony as to value, not the existence of the personal property. In this case, it's it's very clear that there was personal property. Common sense tells you when you're ongoing concern.
Well, wasn't there a servicing agreement or security agreement or something that related to personal property?
There was, and the bill of sale existed. The purchase contract itself identified multiple times that there was personal property coming along with this. Mr. Shaw identified in the Board of Tax Appeals under the Tocles and Sons standard indicated that it is appropriate for the for an owner of a property to identify if they've got specific experience and understanding of the knowledge of not only the existence but the value of the property that it would exist. And we feel in this case that the Board of Tax Appeals has met its standard in reviewing all the evidence before it to first identify that there was personal property.
What about the status of the balance sheet? Was that authenticated as contemporaneous, or was it created for the litigation? Or
To our knowledge, it was created. The litigation took place far after the fact of the existence of the balance sheet being in place in the first point. It was put on before the Board of Revision. As you've seen the record, the Board of Tax Appeals, the parties rested on the testimony or the transcript of the Board of Revision. The Board of Tax Appeals the Board of Education in this case never made any contest of the existence or validity of that balance sheet. Mr. Shaw's testimony identified that it was made for purposes of federal tax purposes, and continuing on with that notion, amounts were identified in there as well as depreciation. You don't put together those type of balance sheets with depreciation models in the, for purposes, I wouldn't think, for creating evidence before a hearing. In this case, the testimony and the evidence of the balance sheet identified there was an approximately $800,000 value in the personal property that was separate and distinct totally from the real property. I might add, I'm sorry I didn't start out with this, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal if it's permissive. We were a cross appellee in this case.
That's correct. Okay.
So I apologize for not bringing that to begin with. The standard review before the Supreme Court has clearly been that they can only overturn unreasonable and unlawful decisions of the Board of Tax Appeals. It's also held in the DAKPLL case versus the Franklin County Board of Revision. It's not a super BTA. And as far as determination of issues of fact, the Board of Tax Appeals is given broad discretion and it's not to be overturned based upon fact itself. If there's an unlawful decision as to the existence of determination of existence of the personal property, that's one thing. We don't believe that's the existence in this case. We think it's quite clear that there was personal property. I don't see how that can be contested. And also the valuation placed upon it was determined to be valid by the Board of Tax Appeals. As to the appraisal that the Board of Education brings up, I'd like to point out a few issues with respect to that. One, as Ms. Fox has indicated, that it was not as of the tax lien date. Secondly, there was no corroborating evidence, there was no corroborating testimonies to that piece of evidence. It was presented to the Board of Revision based upon the policies and procedures of the Board of Revision. We felt important and we felt obligated to provide that appraisal. It was done for the purposes of lending. It was conducted for the benefit of the lender. It was not conducted for the benefit of the taxpayer. And we find that it would be very dangerous for the Board for the Supreme Court to make a determination now that uncorroborated appraisal values would be valid testimony. There'd be a significant number of cases that would be overturned in this case, not only at the BOR level, but at the BTA level if the court opened up that door and permitted uncorroborated appraisals to be determined value of anything with respect to real property. Excuse me. As to the goodwill, Your Honor, unlike the factual issues that relate to the personal property, we feel that there really is a legal issue with respect to the goodwill. The Board of Tax Appeals made a determination that the using the St. Bernard self-storage versus Franklin County Board of Revision case, that the rights under the franchise agreement really were related to rents. While we agree that hotels do generate income based upon rents, what the Board of Tax Appeals failed to realize with respect to franchise rights and the rights and privileges that came with it is the quantitative nature in which those rents could be received. Under the St. Bernard case, the rents were already locked in based upon a long-term lease that existed. In any hotel situation, the rents that are going to be generated from a hotel are really dependent upon a number of different factors, including the things that Mr. Shaw identified in his testimony, the reservation system of the Hawthorne Suites, which was backed by the Hyatt Regency, the name and the standards brought about by the Hawthorne Suites. Customers and clients of this hotel can expect a different level of satisfaction and room quality based upon the fact that it's a Hawthorne Suites.
Let me ask you a question about a point that Ms. Fox made.
Yes, sir.
What does the evidence show, in your view, about whether or not a franchise rights were transferred as part of the sale?
If you look in the franchise, the purchase agreement, there are a couple of different references to the purchase contract in which the franchise rights would be transferred. Specifically, on Article 4, Section 3, there's an Exhibit C to the contract itself that also identify the fact that the franchise agreement existed and was contemplated to be part of the transfer. We don't doubt the fact that any franchisee is going to have a continuing obligation to continue our franchise rights with the franchisor, ultimate franchisor. In this case, we believe that the franchise rights at the time of the transfer had to be transferred along with the personal property. We think that the purchase contract identifies that clearly.
Is there any evidence that the seller had a right to sell those franchise rights apart from selling the real property?
Was there any evidence to the fact that the seller could do that?
Could do that as a separate asset.
I don't know that there's any specific other than the purchase contract which identifies that it was contemplated that was the case. The fact that the franchise agreement was ultimately transferred to the owner obviously is indicative of that to being the fact. The franchise or, which is Hawthorne Suites at this point, certainly permitted that to take place. I'm speaking off the record here, I guess, at the point, because that was never identified, but it certainly existed at the time. It was contemplated at the time. The contract contemplates that that was the existence at the time, or the fact at the time. Going back to my argument, if it's determined, or what we feel that it is appropriate to determine, the Board of Tax Appeals erroneously determined that the rents that were applicable to the franchise agreements were not separate and distinct from the real property. Those franchise rights could be moved from location to location to location. The owner of that hotel could still receive rents from the ongoing rental of the rooms, but it's the quality and the quantity of the values that they were going to be receiving which would have been hindered. Mr. Shaw, during his testimony that the Board of Tax Appeals determined was valid as determinative of all non-valuation issues, indicated that the business or the acquisition price would have been substantially lower had there not been the franchise rights coming along with it, indicative of the fact that the property owner could take those franchise rights and go across the street and benefit from the ongoing reservation system, the Hawthorne Suite standards that existed at the time, and a number of different things to give value to separate hotels, as opposed to a normal mom and pop shop where you could come in and you come into a room, you rent a room. There's no expectation of standard of what the quality of that room is going to be. With the Hawthorne Suites flag, as with any flag that would exist in the hotel industry, there's an expectation by the client or by the customer of the hotel that they're going to be getting a certain quality. And they pay premiums for that based upon that. That's what Mr. Shaw's testimony identified. And we think that that's the primary basis for why this is distinguishable from the St. Bernard self-storage case.
Would there have been a requirement that Mr. Shaw, once the purchase took place, had to separately enter into an agreement with Hawthorne Suites? Is that your understanding?
To the extent that the current franchise agreement would have terminated, there would have been an obligation for him to continue on, or the franchise rights, just like Hawthorne Suites or anyone else, would have terminated. In this case, it was contemplated that the franchise agreement would have continued on to some extent based upon the fact that it was sold as part of the transaction. Once we get to the point where it's a determinative that the Supreme Court finds that the Board of Tax Appeals was unlawful and unreasonable for determining that the goodwill was not separate and distinct from the property. In other words, it was a sellable package that could have been brought about to another location, which I think is clear. It's bound at that point to go back to a factual component to determine that the value of the property, the goodwill in this case, was consistent with the factual determination of the property value with respect to the personal property. The Board of Tax Appeals identified how it valued the personal property based upon the balance sheet and the other testimony at $800,000. That very same testimony and evidence identified the value of the goodwill to be $500,000. The Supreme Court's held in the past that it's unreasonable and unlawful for it to be internally inconsistent to determine that the valuation of one asset is one thing without using the same evidence to determine the value of another thing. In this case, the valuation is determined by the BTA on the goodwill. On the personal property. Also identified the value of the goodwill at $500,000. Once it's determined by the Supreme Court that it was unlawful for the BTA's decision to identify that the business value was not a separate and distinct animal that could be taken apart and moved from location to location to location, in this point it has to determine that the value as appointed by the BTA with respect to valuation be applied the same.
Well, of course, what that balance sheet refers to is goodwill.
It does, yes.
And we've been discussing these franchise rights a lot. Now, are those necessarily the same thing?
Well, in this case, Mr. Shaw identified, although he wasn't speaking specifically to value, he was identifying that the goodwill did relate to the items such as the reservation system and the quantity and quality of that, the name of the Hawthorne Suites and the Hyatt backing. Those type of things Mr. Shaw did identify were part of the goodwill components that were identified in the balance sheet. Those are the type of things he identified. He went on to say, again, that the value of the property acquisition would not have been the same without those components that were generally identified as goodwill, but those were the components that he was
talking about.
Remind
me, what was the timing of that balance sheet with respect to the sale?
The sale was February 3rd of 2005, I believe, was the tax year lending date. That balance sheet was for that tax year. Was
end of the year.
End of the year, yes, sir. And again, as I indicated, the valuations included reductions for depreciation, so it was contemplated that you begin with a certain amount and you reduce down the valuation based upon depreciation over an entire year. The balance sheet itself contemplated full year existence of these assets.
But to the extent then that the value of goodwill was determined, assuming one views the document as, you know, authentic and a good balance sheet.
Yes, sir.
That value of that goodwill is being determined as of the end of the year and could reflect the purchaser's own new agreement with Hawthorne Suites to carry on the Hawthorne Suites
in
flag.
In the event that one existed, that may well be the case, but Your Honor, we don't feel as though at the time of the acquisition you value what existed at the time. We believe that the franchise agreement did exist and was transferred at the time. I'm sorry, does this mean my 3 minutes? I've got 2 minutes, I apologize.
If you'd like to reserve some time.
3 minutes is what I like to reserve. I've got 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
I'd like to reserve my 2 minutes then.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Ernsberger. Ms. Fox, you have 2 minutes and 36 seconds.
Thank you. The Board of Education still takes issue with the fact that a franchise agreement transferred as part of this transaction. It's true that the franchise agreement is listed in Exhibit C. But if you read the full paragraph that references that exhibit, it states, seller is not a party to any license agreements or hotel reservation software license agreement other than those listed and detailed on Exhibit C of this agreement, period. Buyer will enter into a new franchise agreement with Hawthorne Suites to be effective upon the date that buyer begins operation of the hotel. In other words, Exhibit C simply lists, it's simply a disclosure of all licensing and agreements that the seller had at the time of the sale. In no way does that transfer a franchise agreement to the buyer in this case. And there's nothing in the record that clearly establishes that that was the case. Even if that was the case, the Board of Tax Appeals properly found that any additional income that might have been earned from being part of a national hotel chain created value which was properly credited to the realty. Based on this court's previous decisions, it would be improper to separate that value out from the realty. Board of Education also takes issue with the fact that the claim that the Board of Tax Appeals found Mr. Shaw's testimony to be valid. The Board of Tax Appeals allowed Mr. Shaw's testimony to be considered. There was some question as to whether he was the owner, whether he should be, his testimony should be considered at all. They allowed it to be considered, but they said even an owner's opinion of value must be validated by the record. In this regard, we are unable to conclude that the items other than realty should be valued in accordance with Mr. Shaw's testimony. That does not mean that they found his testimony to be credible for all other purposes. They didn't say that. They clearly were focusing on whether or not it was valid with respect to valuation of the non-realty items, and they rejected it. Finally, the documents that are in the record that set forth the value of the personal property as of the time of sale consist of two documents, the appraisal and the security agreement that Your Honor mentioned. Both of those documents value the personal property at the time of sale at $280,000. We find it ironic that appellee argues against the appraisal because it was not corroborated and because it was not as of tax lien date. In fact, the balance sheet on which the BTA relied was not corroborated, and it was further from tax lien date than the appraisal was.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. Mr. Ernstberger, you have 1 minute and 24 seconds on the cross appeal.
As to going back, I want to go back and revisit the issue. I didn't quite finish on the issue of the Tokels and Sons. I'm sorry, the St. Bernard case. We think in this case, it's the Board of Education has brought up the fact that the rents that relate to this are solely related to real property. While rents are related to real property, again, I want to hit this fact again that the quantity of those rents, the value of those rents on a going forward basis, are solely dependent upon the flag that goes into that location, whether it be a Hawthorne Suites, a Red Roof Inn, whatever the case may be. There's going to be a different value in those rents that continue on through the history of that property, that it could be moved again from location to location to location. We feel that it's very clear that the Board of Tax Appeals erred when it made the decision that just because rents exist, that all facts and items relating to those rents are subject to that piece of property and can't be moved. That seems to be what the Board of Tax Appeals decided when it made its decision. It's clear within the text of the writing that they found that anything relating to the rents was subject to the property and could not be moved from location to location as a sellable package. We feel it's clear that anything that has to do with how the value of those rents on a going forward basis clearly can be moved from location to location. And as such, St. Bernard's is clearly distinctive, and the Board of Tax Appeals was erroneous in relying upon that decision in this present case. That's all I have for you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ernstberger.
Yeah.
This case